Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. We've become quite accustomed to reading about our past presidents who continue to serve their nation in one manner or another, most notably, as of late, Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, and George H.W. Bush. Is this a new phenomenon due to increased life expectancies, or is there a history of such post-presidential activity? Our guest this week, Max Skidmore, has looked into the matter in his new book, After the White House, Former Presidents as Private Citizens. As part of our annual celebration of President's Day, he'll tell us what he found. Following that, Kelly Schrum will direct us to a virtual site devoted to presidential elections, and Michael Farquhar will offer us the ninth in his 10-part series of readings from his book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds. But first, as we do every week, let's take a look at a few items of historical interest in the news that you might have missed, all dealing with presidents. 5 months before the Bay of Pigs invasion, the CIA task force plotting to overthrow Fidel Castro concluded that the invasion was unachievable as a covert paramilitary operation. A newly discovered unclassified memo written on November 15, 1960, in preparation for a meeting of CIA officials with President-elect John Kennedy explained, "There will not be the internal unrest earlier believed possible, nor will Castro's defense permit the type of strike first planned. Our second concept of a 1,500 to 3,000-man force to secure a beach with an airstrip," the memo continued, "is also now seen to be unachievable, except as a joint agency, Department of Defense, CIA, Pentagon action." It is not known whether the memo was ever shown to Kennedy, but Kennedy implemented the unachievable CIA-only second option 5 months later, on April 17, 1961, with devastating consequences. According to a newly declassified White House recording, President John Kennedy discussed the feasibility of using nuclear weapons if China attacked India. On the tape, recorded in May 1963, Kennedy and his advisors discussed how to prevent India from becoming another domino to fall to communism. Defense Secretary Robert McNamara said, "Before any substantial commitment to defend India against China is given, we should recognize that in order to carry out the commitment against any Chinese attack, we would have to use nuclear weapons. This is to be preferred over the introduction of large numbers of U.S. soldiers." Kennedy responded that the U.S. should defend India, but made no specific reference as to how he would do it. And finally, another memo, written by Assistant Secretary of State Joseph Sisko in 1969, reveals that Sisko did not believe Israel's assurances that it would avoid acquiring nuclear weapons, and he feared the United States' main ally in the region would spark a Middle East nuclear arms race. Sisko wrote, in part, that intelligence findings suggested Israel was rapidly developing a capability to produce and deploy nuclear weapons. He urged Secretary of State William Rogers to try to curb Israel's ambitions before it was too late. When we return, Fred Nielsen talks with Max Skidmore about the lives of American presidents after they leave the White House. This is Talking History. Just what have presidents done when they're no longer presidents? Have they gone quietly into retirement, held other public offices, performed other forms of public service? All of the above? Talking History's Fred Nielsen explores this bit of history with his guest, Max Skidmore.
The Constitution limits presidents to 2 terms in office. When they leave the White House, they become former presidents, a status they will hold for the rest of their lives, a period often longer than their time of service. What are they to do? What influence can they wield when they return to private life? Library shelves are filled with books about presidential administrations, but my guest, Max Skidmore, has written a book about the post-presidency. Skidmore is a professor of political science at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. His book is After the White House, Former Presidents as Private Citizens. Professor Skidmore, welcome.
Good morning.
Many of our recent presidents, Nixon, Ford, Carter, the first President Bush, lived or continue to live years after leaving the White House, and Bill Clinton, of course, left as a very young man. But yet there are a number of presidents who died in office and others who died shortly thereafter. How many ex-presidents have we really had, people who had a significant post-presidential career?
Well, there have been 42 people who have served in the presidency, even though George W. Bush is called 43. They count Cleveland twice since he had two non-consecutive terms. And of those 42, 8 died in office. So that leaves 34. That means most presidents did have a life after the presidency, although some had a rather truncated life. Polk, for example, died 3 months after he left office, presumably from cholera. Chester Arthur, and Woodrow Wilson each lived a relatively short time. Wilson had been debilitated by a stroke, and Arthur by Bright's disease, a kidney disease. So most former presidents did have a few years. The longest, of course, was Herbert Hoover, who lived 3 decades after he left office.
George Washington was, of course, the first president, but in the context of your book, he's also to be remembered as the first former president.
Right.
You note that everything Washington did, therefore, established a kind of precedent. So it's interesting to read that he didn't necessarily want to establish a precedent by leaving after only 2 terms.
That's right. The conventional wisdom is that Washington wisely stepped aside and therefore established a precedent for future presidents. And in fact, Thomas Jefferson was reassured by that. He was, as a good small-r Republican or Democratic Republican, he feared that once a chief executive held office, he'd never voluntarily leave. Washington did, but he left because he wanted to leave. He didn't leave because he thought that no president should ever serve more than 2 terms. In fact, the Constitutional Convention explicitly rejected a limit on number of presidential terms, and Washington thought the rejection was wise. He thought that the country might someday be in a situation when it would need to retain a president in office, and that it would be unwise to have that kind of rigidity built into it. Harry Truman, who was president when the 22nd Amendment limiting presidential terms was ratified, and he thought it was the worst of all presidential amendments, right up there with the 18th Prohibition Amendment.
You mentioned Jefferson a moment ago, who had an extremely productive post-presidential career. It's his personal library that supplies the books for the new Library of Congress. He helps found the University of Virginia. But you suggest that perhaps an even more important contribution to posterity was his correspondence with John Adams, another former president.
Yes, Jefferson and John Adams had been friends, and then they had a falling out when Jefferson was appointed to the cabinet and Adams was vice president. And they were out of touch for some years and reconnected after both men left the presidency. They never saw one another after that, but they did engage in a very prolific correspondence. And it's a source of fertile ideas and insights into the times and political philosophy and the American mind. It's an extraordinarily rich collection on both ends.
John Adams' son, John Quincy Adams, is in some ways like Jimmy Carter, I suppose. Both are often reckoned to have had unsuccessful presidencies, but extremely successful ex-presidencies. John Quincy Adams, for his part, did something highly unusual. He was elected to the House of Representatives, which might seem like a comedown for a former president.
That's true. There were only 2 presidents who ever returned to Congress. John Quincy Adams is most notable. Andrew Johnson is the other. Adams was elected to the House and Johnson to the Senate, where he served a very brief period before he died. But arguably, the most distinguished part of John Quincy Adams' career did consist of his post-presidential years. He came to be known as Old Man Eloquent, as a curmudgeon in the House, condemning slavery's expansion, resisting the unconstitutional gag rule, and eventually succeeding in shaming the House into overcoming it, the gag rule that prevented the House from receiving petitions that touched on the question of slavery, even though it was clearly unconstitutional. But he did argue the Amistad case before the Supreme Court as well. But Old Man Eloquent, he certainly was, his 18 years or so in the House of Representatives. Very distinguished career.
Theodore Roosevelt leaves office, first of all, he gets to the White House as the youngest president, and he leaves while still a young and vigorous man. I suppose it's not coincidental that he has the longest chapter in your book, and perhaps that he's the one who most vigorously wants to get back into the White House.
Correct. There were 4 former presidents who did run again, and T.R., I started to say he was the most successful. Actually, Grover Cleveland was the most successful because he was reelected. But Theodore Roosevelt was the youngest person at 42 ever to hold the office, and even though he was in almost two full terms, he was the youngest former president we've ever had at age 50. Very vigorous. He spent his life traveling, performing public service, and so forth. He was unhappy with the performance in office of his chosen successor, William Howard Taft, challenged him for the Republican nomination, and upon failing to get that, ran his famous Bull Moose campaign in 1912. And he achieved a unique distinction, being the only minor party candidate ever to come in ahead of a major party candidate. He came in far ahead of Taft, who carried only Utah and Vermont with 8 electoral votes. So T.R. had 88 electoral votes. Sadly, he, too, lost, though, to Woodrow Wilson.
There are some ex-presidents, and I suppose Theodore Roosevelt would be a prime example, who just hate to leave the limelight. He can't get off the stage. The hat's back in the ring. I wonder about the other side of the coin, though. Are there presidents who sought to disappear or who otherwise faded into obscurity?
Yes, there are. Of course, there are those who died not too long after they left office. But Calvin Coolidge, when he left office, was happy to leave, and every now and then he was urged to go back into politics in the few years that he lived, and he just scoffed at it. He had a pretty good insight into himself. He said he could never handle these new socialistic ideas. Now, by new socialistic ideas, he didn't mean those of Franklin Roosevelt. This is when FDR was still governor. He meant those of Herbert Hoover.
There are those who are obscure as presidents and who match their performance after the White House. Franklin Pierce, I think, is an example you mentioned. A failed president and, in a sense, a failed ex-president as well.
Right. He was known for traveling and drinking as a former president. In 1860, after he left office, Franklin Pierce is the quintessential doughface. The doughface was a slang term in the Civil War for men from the North who had Southern principles and sympathies. He was from New Hampshire, and in 1860, after he left office, he urged the Democratic National Convention to choose as its nominee that year, and this is an indication of his degree of perception, his judgment. He urged the convention to nominate none other than Jefferson Davis.
Who became president, but of a very different nation.
Correct.
One of the things we expect presidents to do these days is to spend a lot of energy building their presidential libraries. Who was the first to actually have one?
Well, chronologically speaking, the first president to have a library was Herbert Hoover, but the first library was actually Franklin Roosevelt's. Franklin Roosevelt established his library in his second term in 1939, and Hoover's library didn't come until the 1950s, although Hoover, of course, preceded Franklin Roosevelt in the presidency.
One of the things I was struck by in your book was the relatively recent development of the idea or awareness of the idea that former presidents have some claim on protection, mailing privileges, office space, some way of dealing with all these requirements of being a former president.
That's right. Until the post-presidency of Harry Truman in the Dwight Eisenhower years in the 1950s, former presidents had nothing, and there were a number of instances, particularly during the 19th century, in which former presidents were quite pressed by financial troubles because of their time in the presidency. Harry Truman actually had to borrow money to travel back home after he left the presidency, and he urged a friendly Congress with Lyndon Johnson as majority leader and Sam Rayburn as Speaker of the House, majority leader of the Senate, that is, to do something to help assist him with his office expenses. He didn't ask for a pension. But what resulted from that was a pension for former presidents, ultimately Secret Service protection, and payment for office expenses and support in another initiative of President Truman, support for organizing the papers of presidents after they leave office.
It's been increasingly common for former presidents to write their memoirs. Bill Clinton's, of course, was a very thick book and a bestseller. Are they any good?
Well, some of them are. Clinton's book was quite interesting, and most recent presidents have produced memoirs that are certainly worth reading, but there are at least two that are real classics. U.S. Grant's is probably the most distinguished of all. His memoirs did not really deal to any extent at all with his presidency, but they're one of the keenest war memoirs written in the English language, or perhaps in any language. They were a major contribution to American letters, written in a very brief period, 10 months at a time when he was dying of throat cancer and in terrible pain. He was fearful of leaving his widow destitute. And as it turned out, it set a record for royalties and so forth. But he demonstrated not only great heroism, but great literary style. Another one is Theodore Roosevelt's autobiography, one of distinction, one that's fascinating to read. And then there are others such as, probably at the bottom of the heap, you might put James Buchanan's. James Buchanan as president actually conspired with the Supreme Court to bring out the infamous Dred Scott decision. James Buchanan was another doughface. The Dred Scott decision, which he thought would settle the slavery issue. Well, clearly it didn't. He wrote his memoirs after he left office, thinking that would vindicate his administration in the eyes of historians, and they didn't either.
Politicians inevitably acquire enemies along the way. How well do ex-presidents, as a rule, get along with their successors and, for that matter, with each other after they leave the office?
Ex-presidents often get along very well with one another. Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower had notable bad blood when Eisenhower was president, and there was tremendous friction. But after Eisenhower left office, the two old war horses buried the hatchet and seemed to enjoy one another's company. The most obvious president who is in a position to influence a successive president is former President George Bush, George H.W. Bush, who would seem to be in a unique position to have a channel to and influence upon his son George W. Bush. On the other hand, the Bush family is very private, and so it's difficult to know precisely what that influence, if any, is. But from all appearances, the younger Bush not only has conducted his presidency in such a way that it's a rejection of the presidency of his father, but also in some ways designed to humiliate his father. His father, on the other hand, it appears as though he is reluctant to, certainly to do anything public, but even to pressure his son directly. But indirectly, there are some pressures. For example, the Bush Foundation, the Bush Library, gave a Distinguished Public Service Award to one who has been one of the most outspoken critics of George W. Bush and the war in Iraq, and that was Senator Ted Kennedy.
The nature of the presidency has changed a lot over the years. A 20th century or 21st century president has powers never imagined in the 19th. We talk about the imperial presidency these days. Has the ex-presidency changed as well?
Yes, I think it has, but I think more than a generic change is that it depends upon the character of former presidents. Former President Reagan was a dynamic figure, in some ways a charismatic figure, at least to many people. But after he left office, even though his memory is held by many, he had relatively little influence. Of course, his mental powers are rapidly diminishing, and so that's partly understandable. He was by far the oldest president ever in office, and therefore the oldest ex-president as well. Bill Clinton was, for a time, more than a rival of George Bush. In the early months of the George Bush presidency, whenever Bush would make a speech and Clinton would make a speech the same day, it appears as though Clinton got the publicity and George Bush didn't. Of course, 9/11 changed that to a considerable degree. President Clinton has gotten along well with both Presidents Bush, and in contrast, their former President Carter has had starchy relations not only with the Bushes, but with President Clinton when he was in office. So a lot depends just on the personalities of the presidents involved. George Bush has named Clinton, along with his father, the former President Bush, to assist in tsunami aid and things of that sort. Why did he not select Jimmy Carter, the well-known humanitarian, the only one whose former presidency rivals and perhaps even exceeds that of John Quincy Adams? Well, Jimmy Carter is well-known for speaking his mind and for being rigid and for being a moralist. Bill Clinton is well-known for being an accommodationist and seeking to mediate and to smooth things over and to achieve consensus, and that certainly is a quality that a current president would value much more than someone who will speak up to him.
As we conclude, perhaps we can sum up. Is it possible to generalize about the degree of influence that former presidents have?
I think that it's not really possible to generalize. You can make a few broad generalizations. As a rule, younger presidents are more likely to have longer careers, of course, and influence after they leave office. But that isn't necessarily the case. Millard Fillmore was young when he left office. James Polk was young when he left office, and Polk died 3 months after he left office. Theodore Roosevelt was young when he left office and had a very vigorous, almost decade of life after he left the presidency. Andrew Jackson was the oldest person to be president before Dwight Eisenhower, and people thought that therefore he would have no influence. Well, he wasn't nearly the vigorous ex-president that he had been as president, but he nonetheless was more or less an elder statesman for some years, as long as he lived, as was Dwight Eisenhower. But generalizations are tricky, and there are few enough men who have served in the presidency, and I say men, one day we will be able to say people, because there will be women presidents as well, I'm convinced. But there are few enough of them that we probably don't need to generalize. We can just look at each one as a person in his own right, who represents an administration in his own right, and affects the politics and the public life of Americans in their own way after they leave office.
Well, as Emerson once said, all history is, properly speaking, biography. It's the individual in the end.
Right.
Professor Skidmore, thanks for talking.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking with Max Skidmore, author of After the White House, Former Presidents as Private Citizens.
Continuing our celebration of President's Day, Kelly Schrum joins us to tell us about a virtual site where you can spend some time, preferably after the show, exploring the history of presidential elections. Schrum is the Assistant Director of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University.
Imagine a cartoon showing a dismally gray industrial town. Factories crumble with disuse, and a spiderweb hangs between two smokestacks. Suspended in the middle of the web is an ugly, poisonous spider wearing the face of William Jennings Bryan. The spider has entangled prosperity in its web. This cartoon from October 1908 plays on fears that Democratic presidential hopeful Bryan would end American prosperity and cause profound damage to American industry. This site documents American presidential elections from 1860 to 1912. A detailed 3,000-word overview places each election in a larger political and cultural context and discusses the major issues relevant to the election. The producers have also included an essay on the practice of campaigning, how it has changed over the centuries, how those changes have resulted in increased democratization of the political process, and how the press has shaped political campaigns. In addition, the site exhibits more than 600 political cartoons from elections, drawn from Harper's Weekly, Vanity Fair, and Puck, among others, and provides biographies for each of the candidates. Events sections discuss major happenings before, during, and after each election period. Teachers should be aware that some materials contain racial epithets. Due to the many primary sources, including cartoons, campaign banners, and political artwork, this site offers an excellent introduction to elections, politics, and political cartoons from 1860 to 1912. To locate this site, visit historymatters.gmu.edu and type elections into the keyword search.
And finally, Michael Farquhar joins us for the ninth in his 10-part series of readings from his book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds. This week, he has selected a chapter titled Special Delivery from Bondage from Part 9 of his book, Escapes Hatched.
I entered the world a slave, Henry Box Brown wrote in his autobiography, in the midst of a country whose most honored writings declare that all men have a right to liberty. It was from this dehumanizing system of bondage, where his wife and children were sold away from him by men who called themselves Christians, that Henry Brown was determined to escape. I now began to get weary of my bonds, he wrote of that terrible time when his family was taken away, and earnestly panted after liberty. To achieve it, he came up with a simple yet daring plan. He would have himself mailed to freedom in Philadelphia. A carpenter built a shipping crate, barely large enough to contain him, while a sympathetic shopkeeper in Richmond agreed to have a friend of his take possession of the human cargo when it arrived in the North. Brown then had to contrive an excuse to be absent from his master's tobacco plant so he wouldn't be missed while the plan was executed. He had an injured finger, but it wasn't enough to satisfy the overseer. So Brown's friend Dr. Smith procured for him some corrosive oil of vitriol. It burned his finger to the bone when he applied it, but the damage persuaded the overseer to excuse him. On the morning of March 29, 1849, Brown met Dr. Smith and the shopkeeper at the place that had been arranged for him to be packed into the crate. Several breathing holes were bored into the box, which measured only 3 feet 1 inch in length, 2 feet in width, and 2 feet 6 inches in height, a dangerously tight squeeze. Brown's only provision was a flask of water. "Being thus equipped for the Battle of Liberty," he wrote, "my friends nailed down the lid and had me conveyed to the express office, which was about a mile distant from the place where I was packed. I had no sooner arrived at the office than I was turned heels up while some person nailed something onto the end of the box." He would be at the mercy of careless cargo handlers throughout the arduous journey. During a transfer from train to steamboat, for example, he was left upside down and was convinced he was going to die. "I felt my eyes swelling as if they would burst from their sockets," he wrote, "and the veins on my temples were dreadfully distended with pressure of blood upon my head." After 27 hours and several more mishaps, including being dropped on his head during a transfer in Washington, D.C., Henry Brown emerged in Philadelphia, but not quite a free man. The Fugitive Slave Act, passed in 1850, eventually forced him to escape once again to Britain. It was a longer journey, but at least he didn't have to endure it as cargo.
You've been listening to Michael Farquhar, reading from his new book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds, published by Penguin Books. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beatty is our producer and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thank you for listening. This is your host, Brian LeVeau.